My man, he don't love me. Treats me awful mean. He don't love me. Treats me awful mean. He's the lowest man that I seen. He wears high draped pants. Stripes are really yellow. He wears high draped pants. Stripes are
That's the great, great lady herself, Ella Fitzgerald, singing Fine and Mellow. She's doing it fine and mellow, too. It's a blues classic, and she's a classic. And the Sidemen in this beautiful rendition are themselves classics. They've all gone on to glory, every single one in this production. But they all made their marks in the great world of music before they left, including Joe Pass on guitar, Eddie Lockjaw Davis on tenor sax, Zoot Sims also on sax, Harry Sweets Edison on trumpet, Clark Terry also on trumpet, Tommy Flanagan on piano, Ray Brown on bass, and Louis Belson on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead with a funny thing in my voice. It's a long story, but I'll tell you about it in a minute. It's Tuesday, October the 29th, and it's open forum. Of course, you know that means you take the conversation where you want it to go, and you can call in at 888-874-4888. I am a victim of environmentalism. We had a situation here where, they... outside of the perimeter of the complex that I live in, they're doing some termite abatement, and it already occurred at least a week and a half ago, and for some reason I just get this reaction. And I was trying to figure out what is it, and then it dawned on me what it is. So bear with me with my crazy voice, but we'll continue. 888-874-4888. A whole bunch of things are happening. Now comes word with respect to the ongoing saga of Obamacare that the company that got the contract, the no-bid contract, they did not have to bid for it. $678 million. Remember, I was asking the very first thing that came up about the contract for the computer company And I said, but nobody's discussing who, what's the cost and who got the contract and how did they get the contract? Well, now comes word that the contract was a no-bid contract, $678 million, and a classmate of Michelle Obama is a top executive at that company. The company is CGI. It has a U.S. affiliate, but actually it's a Canadian company. But that's all that they're saying so far. They have not yet explained how the $678 million contract was awarded, and only CGI was considered, no other company. This is a report that is just now coming out. And this is how this happens. You know, people make a lot of money, a ton of money in these situations. All right, so we have Richard from Virginia. How are you?
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, got a question for you.
Okay. You sound like you have the phone on speaker. It gives
let me take it off speaker.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you so much.
Okay. Could you just give me your updated opinion on Snowden as far as NSA revelations for, and with Greenwald too, him and Greenwald, the revelations as to spying, especially with respect to the latest ones on, you know, Germany, Brazil, Mexico, Spain, et cetera?
Well, they do sound, I mean, the revelations as they are, they do sound quite sensational, but in the world of espionage, this is really nothing new. They all know it. All governments are spying on other governments. They all do this. That's the world of espionage. That's why it's called espionage. You spy. And it goes back all the way, I mean, through history. The history of countries is one of spying. I mean, it goes back even to biblical times. Moses had a spy, several spies. I mean, spying, if we look at it, we look at it as lay people, of course, and it's outrageous. However, in the world of spying, this is nothing new. We have to come to terms with here a couple of things. And I'm not suggesting that, you know, we just say it's okay. The question here for me personally, I raised very early a question about his tactics. I still hold to that. I think I think it was not right what he did. And it isn't right what he did. And I think about it from a different point of view than most people, I think. He was employed. I mean, and he later revealed that he intended his employment to be the channel through which he will get all this information. And I did say at the beginning, at the very beginning, and it turned out I was right, that they were onto him. They knew that something was up. They were onto him, and he knew that they were onto him. And this revelation, or these series of revelations, are his defense. His defense is a very good offense, and it's working. There is, and bear with me, because it's a very complex thing that I'm dealing with here, okay? So bear with me.
Okay.
If this is what he intended to do, and it appears that he is resigned to reaping the consequence of his actions, then that's one thing. That's fine. Then there's no problem there as I see it. He's just like Bradley Manning. He's resigned to whatever the consequence is. To what extent do we condone what he has done? That's an ethical question. because at the same time that he's done this and at the same time that we're learning a lot about the nature of spying and the nature of the state versus the individual, and we come into a discussion about our rights as we perceive them and as we perceive them within the context of the society that we understand that we have, in which the individual's rights also matter, and that the state should not be so overwhelmingly powerful that in the understanding that we have of our democratic rights and our so-called democracy, this is what we've been talking about on an ongoing basis, the right of the individual also to be left alone. So this is a very legitimate discussion. But the notion of spying and the nature of the state and the conduct of the state is not new because of Snowden. Snowden's revelations remind us that we do have to revisit this question. But I have huge problems, just the same, with what he did, because in many ways it is endangering certain aspects of the operation of our state. And we have to appreciate that also. One of the operations, and it sounds very pro-government here, but it is a legitimate argument. All countries spy. All countries find a need to spy, to gather intelligence in that sense, as a matter of national defense. And that is true. If you're running a country in today's age, you need to have some national body, some apparatus that prepares you to defend the whole country, given the nature of how the world works, where people spend inordinate amounts of time and effort and energy planning how to destroy other countries. This happens all the time. And again, this is not new. You look at any society and the nature of war and warmongering and defense and all, these are ancient principles. Because it is the nature of human beings, unfortunately, to behave badly. And it is the nature of countries to especially countries that see themselves as powerful, to dominate others. That can't happen without having intelligence gathering. That can't happen without spying. So, I mean, even in our own lives, our own individual lives, this is a philosophical question. Do you conduct and do I conduct our lives in such a way in which we do not give any attention to our safety? That is implausible. We think about our safety all the time. We think about how best to protect ourselves against people who intend to do us harm. We don't intend to harm others, but people do intend to harm us. How do we prepare ourselves to defend ourselves against that possibility? Okay, so that's a question on the national level and an international level. Where I have trouble with Snowden goes to a complex analysis that places the whole question of race in America. African Americans, Native Americans, people who have been oppressed in this country for a long time have been talking about their oppression by the state. And it never seems to matter. It never had mattered much to the whole society. When African Americans were complaining that our leaders were being slaughtered and irrational and unreasonable things were being done to harm us as a group, all the oppressed communities, Native Americans, when they were raising these questions, these were dismissed in the largest societal sense, because the belief, even within the progressive community, is, hey, that's your problem. we are not suffering, so you guys have to take it upon yourselves to figure out what you want to do. And not on only a national level, but on an international level. African Americans and African leaders and Africans in the diaspora were being wiped out like crazy. And we didn't seem to get traction within white America society, of white America, a responsible reaction, a reaction that says they understood this to be a human issue. It was dismissed. So the fact that we are now concerned because Ed Snowden is the agent through which these realities are becoming clear, that disturbs me. And the question then is, why now? Why is it an issue now? Because of Edward Snowden. There's some ethical questions about Snowden's behavior too. Here's a young man who this is part of what I consider. Here's a young man who, by any application of what we consider to be normal in our society, would never have had that opportunity as a young man without a high school diploma, who had the ability to land a job, a six-figure job, given the benefit of doubt to his character. He was not vetted as closely as say, those people who went to Macy's to buy some goods, or to Barney's to buy a belt. I mean, they apprehended them right away. They were suspect right away. But he eluded that suspicion, I would suspect, purely and largely on the basis of his skin color. He was able to enjoy privileges that most people of color would never never enjoy. He lived very well at the expense of the very same agency that he ended up decrying. He received the benefits of that. He was able to make money on the stock market, play the stock market, make profits. He was able, before the age of 30, to do things most people of color would not be able to do even in their lifetime, which is to acquire property and buy a house, and live a standard of life that most people of color in a similar situation would not be able to do. So we have that issue of the society. How is it that people, if we were looking at this in the real world where we exist, that factor plays a huge role. And therefore, the credibility of a Snowden with respect to the information that has been garnered and shared, with the intent that the world community now is being educated via the agency of a young white man. This is very interesting, that the world is now fully upset, and the information brought forth is credible. You would notice that none of the people in this circle are of color. I'm not suggesting that I would feel better if the information were brought forward by an African American or Latino, but I'm saying this: we look at it in this way because this is very important as well. The credibility of Snowden is automatic. Had anybody else said it, it would not have been. It would not have been automatic. Or there would be trouble with it. Somehow they would not readily accept that these things happen. So,
well,
number one for me, the information is insightful. I mean, it is a reminder of how powerful nations can be, or the system of governance can be, especially when it is of the nature that it is in terms of spying. But we are not new to that. That is not something new to me, let me put it that way. And for many people in the non-white world, this is par for the course. Been living it for a long, long time. It comes with a number of things. That here's a situation in which this information is not especially bad under Obama, as it might have been under Bush, or as it might have been under Clinton. I also cannot dismiss the fact that it happened, these revelations have occurred at this time with an African-American president, or, you know, this is a very serious issue because it does in the end have a very serious impact on his presidency. But then again, we still have the question. We don't know what Snowden knows. Snowden has become part of a group of people, which would include now Julian Assange and others, who have occupied a particular space of authority. And the question then is, you know, what qualifies them other than the fact that they could steal information and basically we don't know whether it's sold, we don't know who has it. No questions are asked about who are these people and what right have they to do these kinds of things. And if they do these kinds of things and are reaping the repercussions of them, why should we find it abnormal that they would in fact reap the rewards of their actions? And this is where I am with it.
Well, how about it's looking like President Obama is starting to say or imply that he didn't even know that they were, the NSA was making or was, you know, listening in on Merkel's cell phone, and then Feinstein now is implying that, you know, everything needs to be checked out, that which is kind of implying she didn't know.
Yeah, well, everybody would do that. I mean, that is quite normal because there are, again, if you understand how situations work in a government, there is a permanent government within the government. The president, and it can choose. I don't know if you've ever seen a movie called 5 Days in May.
No.
Oh, it's a fantastic movie. You should find it. It's about a group of generals who basically take over the government. Without the knowledge, I mean, the president became aware of it very late in the game. It's an excellent movie. But the thing is that the president clearly has issues, and this is a serious discussion that this country ought to have. I am not, as you know, I'm not a great fan of President Obama, because I think he has been a deep disappointment to a constituency that is desperate for help, several constituencies, and it supported him. However, I'm very much aware that the conduct of the apparatus of government in his tenure is also unusual. It's been openly racist toward him. It has been, therefore, there are people who, within the administration, are plotting against him. I mean, it's so clear. They would, purely on the basis that they resent him on his race. I mean, we have Snowden, okay, a 30-something-year-old young man, opining openly and with great derision about having to work, having to live in a society headed by this president. His father has openly expressed what I consider to be rather prejudiced opinions about Obama and his ability, his capacity for leadership. And then, you know, you wonder, who are these people to come up with this? I mean, what is the basis of that except race? I'm very much aware that this president has faced an inordinate challenge within his administration, and even he way underestimated the level of resistance and the racism he would encounter as the head of state. This government is openly derisive, contemptuous of his leadership. It's racist in reaction to him, and he apparently cannot, and I appreciate the quagmire that he's in, he cannot openly talk about it. He cannot openly express what he's experiencing on the inside. But you can clearly see that this, in many ways, is a renegade government, people taking it upon themselves to do whatever they want. And he is unable to rein them in. So there's a very delicate dance going on in Washington, D.C. The president actually you can see the result. He's actually operating with a bunker mentality, and it's so understandable because he has to deal with a rebellious administration. A lot of these things that are happening to him, you can find the root in racist opinions about him, racist attitudes. This is the first African-American president they've had to deal with. And one could hardly believe that simply because he occupies the office of the president that people will behave. No. They express their racist attitudes at a high level. And it's in the military, the way that they've been conducting themselves. It's in the federal bureaucracy. It's all around him. But we know that. You see, African Americans know this. We get it. We understand it as par for the course. This is what I mean. Snowden's so-called revelations, in and of themselves, are quite deep. I mean, that this is what government does. But it is not unique to the Obama administration. We understand this We understood this a long time ago. We expect it. We're not thrown by it. Now, whites have a different reaction because they're used to being in control. And it is not a good feeling to be out of control, whether the chief executive is African-American or not. They understand implicitly that they have rights, and they have rights that are enforceable against the state. Most people do not understand that. Most people do not enjoy that, so they get it, that this conduct of the government is what, in fact, is the norm for most of non-white America. I know that's very strange to understand, but that's the way it is. Most people I talk to in my circle, you know, it's interesting, you know, that the state power should be expressed in the way that it is, but it is not necessarily a jolt to us. We get it. We've been living it for a long time.
Who do you think the renegade government is?
How do I know? I mean, the business.
Yeah.
You look at the military. You look at the apparatus of government. You look at the administration. You see how people are misbehaving. They're not taking their lead. They're not allowing the president to do what he has to do. President Obama came in as president with the understanding that he was going to be a controlled person. He did not come into the presidency as his own man, with his own vision and his own power and his own apparatus of power. He only came in with overwhelming support from the people. And that is no big deal in the world of politics, the way a country is governed. It only means that they have to give the illusion that he is the leader, but he is not the leader. We understand this. We get that. Because if he were his own man, so many things that are happening here would never have happened.
I agree.
Okay, so we get that. But in the double helix, the racial double helix that we've been living as America, the white-black double helix, or the white and non-white double helix here in the United States, people who have been oppressed for a long time understand the complexity of the nature of his governance, and they understand implicitly the challenges that he will have. We keep hoping somehow that he could flex his muscle and get certain things done, but he first must answer to, and he first must obey the invisible power that actually prevails. That is the power that he first must answer to. So this is how I see Snowden. I still see him as a spy. I mean, he's a spy who got caught, and he knew he was going to get caught. So this is his reaction. It turns out that was a correct assessment. They were on him. They were on to him. And and make no mistake, under that wonderful calm demeanor and the earnestness and all of this stuff, is a person with a very lethal intent, because he understands, even as a young man in his 30s, he understands very clearly the power to destroy. And it's the same kind of power that Julian Assange has, that they have information, which is their weapon of choice. It's like a nuclear bomb. They wield it like that. They understand it. And they therefore are, and this is my position. These folks, nobody finds out, well, are you mentally okay? Are you even, are you on an even keel? Are you fully developed? Could we trust that you see? We just have to wait and see what he does. And that's his understanding of power. Now, in that world where people operate this way to the point where major impact can be made on hidden plans of countries. Don't forget now, this is not just a simple world of an investigative reporter. No, no. This is in the world of espionage. He's now operating in that world of espionage. And there are no rules except that one side utterly must win and the other side utterly must lose. There's no medium, there's no middle ground here. So he should understand that. And people want to say, well, you know, it's going to be wrong for in fact, people are saying it now. It is wrong for the United States, despite the damage he's caused, that the United States should have take any sanction against him. He's to remain free. Well, hey.
Well, thanks for taking my call, and I appreciate your opinion on all that.
Thanks a lot for asking the question.
Have a good one.
You're on the air, Sarah. Hello?
Greetings, Futrice.
Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. I had my phone now. Futrice, what I was going to speak on, and, you know, not even to get tied up, sidetracked so much with Snowden, because you wanted to know who's funding him, that he's been able to live this well for so long. Forget his stocks and bonds that he so-called was investing in. There's some other organization that has been able to fund him, that he's been able to live in this hotel and everywhere else he's been skipping all over the place as some celebrity living out this so-called life and getting all of these awards while he keeps dropping these little dimes all over the place to expose what's going on in this administration. I'm like you. I don't care for this, for the administration, but I see this as him trying to create conflict, because every day you come out, now Spain is upset, Germany is upset, France is upset, Great Britain, all of these countries are bit by bit, they're being revealed how long they've been under surveillance and all of this stuff. So it seems that they are out there to create dissension in world policies against the United States. So he's been put up for something else. But I'm sidetracking for what I mainly call in to talk about, which is you were speaking on yesterday with a Terry McAuliffe, the Clinton faction, and him running for the governor of Virginia.
Yes.
I remember when the late Maynard Jackson of Atlanta, the first black mayor, when he was running for the DNC head position against Terry McAuliffe.
Mm-hmm.
And the Clintons, they came in, and they backed Terry McAuliffe to make sure that he get that position. And they did to Maynard Jackson exactly what was done to Jim Clyburn when he was going for the assistant speaker under Pelosi, give him some non-essential position in the DMC that they created and they made up just in order to pacify him, because they had no intentions whatsoever of letting Maynard Jackson, even though he has done so much for the DNC, as all of these blacks have always done, they always run out here, do all of these registrations and get everybody to run along and vote for the donkey and do all of this other nonsense. They had no intention of ever putting him in that top position. just like they always like to trot out Vernon Jordan and bring him out there to show, oh, he's a friend of the Clintons and he golfs with the Clintons and he's so high up and blah, blah, blah. But they only select certain key individuals and bring them in there. And I'm sure that Alton has discussed with you the connections with Vernon as well as the Clintons and how, you know, he's from Georgia. He didn't get his bar registration, his law bar registration in Georgia. He went off to Arkansas and got, and that's where he was first registered as an attorney, got his law license in Arkansas. So it showed you how these people that we like to look up to as so-called elite members in the black club, so to speak, how they're really and truly, they're not out there to do anything for us. And once again, these people, the Clintons and Terry McAuliffe and James Carville from my husband's home state of Louisiana, they are nothing but rats. They are nothing but the dirty, nasty rats, the operatives in the Clinton administration who have no, you know, they're not even refined. Carville is not even refined in his racism. He's just a good old redneck from out to the bayou of Louisiana.
Wait a minute. Gotta slow down them. I'm concerned about your heart rate right about now.
No, my heart rate is fine. But I'm just showing that James Carville, he's not even so refined. His wife, no, Mary Matlin, she could, you know, more, she's a bit more refined. But this thing in the what's going on, getting ready to happen in Virginia, as you were saying, that they did everything they could not to have more than two political parties, the two prominent ones, to run for office. You see, they don't want to have any other political parties in this country.
Absolutely not. McAuliffe himself at one point had tried to pay off Ralph Nader to get out of the race, you know, to actually pay him to get out of the race. He should have known better than that. Ralph Nader has a very strong sense of ethics. But the thing is that the lesson here really has to do with how this political society runs. It is about raw power. It isn't about serving the needs of people. It has nothing to do with that. It is about get me into the club so that I could make money for myself and for my circle, but mostly for myself. That's the whole point of being elected to office. It gives you the platform for money making, and that's where a lot of people are. And McAuliffe is one of the, I mean, he's a super Clintonite in that sense. So that's why they understand the need to come in.
Like I said, you know, even James Carville, they're right up there. That's why even when James Carville was so phony coming out and showing that, yeah, he support Obama because he's a Democrat, you could really and truly see that he was being forced to do this, you know, to toe the party line to come out there. But every once in a while, when he couldn't hold it in no more, here it is, it would pop out and he would just come out right out and say exactly what it is he really mean to say.
Well, you know, again, and I wish that we would, I mean, in the middle of all of this stuff and all of our critiques of Obama, to maintain a sense of reality about what is happening to him within his world, within his world, which we don't see, but we can, we see the expression of it. We see the intensity of which a whole bunch of folks absolutely resent the idea that he's head of state. They just can't deal with it. They don't want to deal with it. They have no intention of dealing with it. And so this particular administration, you see a lot of evidence that people are running their own show, that they refuse in their own way to understand that they're accountable to the head of state. Thanks a lot for calling, Sarah. Thank you so much. Thank you. Michael from New Jersey, how are you? Hello? Okay, we have L.A. How are you?
Hello, Utrecht and DX, how are you?
How are you doing? Good, thanks.
I'm doing fine. I wanted to talk about the two stories you went over yesterday. I was sitting here just incensed. I was boiling over because I'm going to get to the point in a second here, but I'm from the state of Virginia originally, born and raised half my childhood there. And this race in Virginia, it shows what I say all the time. They're not going to let a viable third party into any of the races that they have access to, especially the Clintons and this guy McAuliffe. Like you said, he's a money machine. He's connected with money. So this shows how they'll lie, they'll cheat, they'll do anything to keep a libertarian, let's say, like Sarvis, out of it. And they'll do the same thing to any progressive you try to put up there who's getting any sort of steam, starting to roll. They'll do the same thing because they don't care. They're unscrupulous. The Clintons are, and this guy is too. All, the whole Democratic Party is corrupt, and that's why you say, and I agree with you, it's time to dump them, leave them alone.
Yep.
And then this other, and I'm going to connect the two in a second, but then this other story.
You are anticipating me now.
I'm going to connect them. This other story about these 14 pimps of the prosperity gospel who mm-hmm. only are going to deliver pain and poverty to the black community, and they've been doing it, and they're going to continue to do it because they're all sellouts. I mean, I was sitting here just listening to this going, man, you know, how, when are black people, the black community going to just wake up and see that these people are selling you down the river? And where I'm getting at with both of these stories, the connection is that the whole political establishment, the whole mainstream religion, mainstream media, it's all connected. And what we need to do, this is what I'm getting at, is dump all of them. Don't participate in their phony elections. Don't participate in buying their products from these major stores. Don't participate in this religion stuff that they put out there to exploit you. I mean, namely, the black community needs to do this. We need to have our own, you know, vote in local elections, local farmers markets. And what I see, though, happening here is it's mostly in the black community, it's mostly the older people who are not getting it.
Oh, I would disagree.
No. We have younger people that are starting to come around, like the young lady mm-hmm. who called last week from Brooklyn. I think her name was Darka or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, Darka. Darka.
Yeah, she said that she was in college in 2008 when he was running. Everybody was pressuring her to vote for him. She ended up voting for him. Well, she, I think, is indicative of a lot of young black people who are coming to realize that they were sold a bill of goods.
You see, my thing, I see where you're going, and I agree with you. However, I believe, on the one hand, the retreat is a very good tactic. You retreat from things that are harming you. But in this race in Virginia, as I was trying to point out, the best solution, from a strategic point of view, the best solution would have been to go with the third candidate, Sarvis, who is running as a libertarian, go into his camp. I'm sure he would have been very, very grateful for the help. And from a strategic point of view, you break with the Democratic Party and you endorse a young man who presents himself as a pretty good alternative, and you endorse him and you work with him. Simply in your interest. That would have been a smart strategy.
I agree with you as far as that's the optimal thing that should happen. I just don't think it would or it's going to happen because our society, first of all, most people get their news from television and radio still. They don't really, and especially when there's elections, it's about who has the most money, who can put the most TV commercials up, who can convince the public. I mean, they come on these commercials and they lie like crazy. Media is very pervasive in our society. It's, people believe whether we want to think so or not, people believe what's put in front of them, especially these people who watch the mainstream media. And this is what I'm saying. If that young man had a chance to get up there and debate these two people, you know, two-on-one, one-on-one, or whatever, with each one of them, he would have been able to prove that these both are full of S-word, okay?
Because of that, this is what I'm saying, because of these things, because he was locked out, and because they brought in the heavy artillery, the two Clintons, it should be the case in our community that wherever the Clintons are, you automatically go the other way. Whoever they like, you dislike. Whoever they endorse, you don't support.
But you see, that's our point of view.
That should be the calling card. If the Clintons like it, you are compelled to hate it.
I agree. However, that is our point of view. But you have to realize that the biggest majority of people, and I believe especially in the South, in these states, like Virginia is still part of the South, but, I mean, they're not listening to progressive radio stations. Most of these people are looking at the mainstream media. And when you lock a guy out from the debate, see, this is why I say that federally and even statewide sometimes we don't have a chance, because they're going to lock a progressive candidate or a libertarian candidate out of the debates. And that's the most important part. That's when you get to see them confront each other and one idea up against another, quote-unquote. Mm-hmm. And so if you can lock a person out of the debates, pretty much they're done. Because, see, most people in Virginia probably don't even know that the Democratic Party basically and the Republican Party forced this guy out on, falsely. I mean, he should be there. Like his wife said, she showed he got 10% or more. He should be there. They did something illegal. They did something immoral. And, see, they can get away with it because there's no light shined on it, because the mainstream media is not going to shine a light on this at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So
very much
they
so.
Control the media. They control the debates. They control the whole situation, the Republican and Democratic Party. So this is why that tack is not going to be successful against them, because they're always going to find a way to cheat, to lie, to force you out, whatever candidate you put there. So,
thank you. You're right. I'm thinking, though, that what has to happen, even if it's small, but it has to be significant, and that is the articulation, the public articulation of disgust with this party, and it is to be buttressed by a complete turnaround in action. People have to show a different kind of attitude. It has to be demonstrable. It has to be quantified. You know, this many people no longer are with the okey-doke Democratic Party. We have gone beyond that, and we're now looking for a new way. Thanks, DX, for your call.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Michael from New Jersey, you're back with us.
I hope you can hear me.
Yes, we can. Very well.
I picked some things out of the paper this Sunday, and some of the facts that your listeners are probably familiar with, but among 16 to 24-year-olds, there are 5.8 million disconnected people. No school, no job. They're adrift in society. Their median household income has fallen 8.3% lower than in 2007, the year before the 2008 recession. And the percentage of people who have a job or are actively seeking a job fell in August to the lowest rate in 35 years. Now, according to Pew Research, during the first 2 years of the nation's economic recovery, the net worth of those in the top 7% of the wealth distribution rose 28%, while the rest of the 93% fell by 4% in their net worth. So I have to ask the question of what kind of society that we want. I mean, this is not the case in countries like Sweden, Norway, Netherlands, Finland, Denmark, Germany, Switzerland. They don't have these problems.
But, you know, even as awful as those statistics are that you've just put before us, it is more even more horrific when you look at the permanent underclass. Those are just, I mean, when
those
you look
the
at
average.
The permanent
I
underclass,
agree.
At, right, when you look at the what is happening at the at that level, it is an act of inhumanity. It should be, something that's prosecutable to have people living this way in a country this wealthy and this great superpower.
Yeah, well, it's rocketing in two different directions. The 93% are rocketing in one direction, and the 7% are rocketing in the other direction. And I took a look at some other statistics and things, and I saw that out of 31 industrialized nations, the United States is 27th out of 31 in the amount of expenditures on welfare programs, social programs, health, education, welfare, housing, and, you know, food subsidies and pensions.
Well, I remember, if you recall, just recently I've been doing a series, occasional series, on this very question of how do you measure this thing called democracy? And it has nothing to do with voting. It has to do with the quality of access that people have to the strategic resources of society. And I said, look, just take six, just six. Food was its first one. Housing or shelter, education, health care, safety, and what was the other one? Food, housing, safety. Well, there's another one. There were six.
Mm-hmm.
I have to bone up on my ginkgo biloba. But in six categories, the United States is unbelievably hostile to human life
there's a war on the poor. Actually, there's a hatred and a war on the poor.
Of course.
And you know the countries that I mentioned.
Oh, employment! I forgot. Employment was the big one. How dare I forget that? Employment. This is how we measure our democracy or quality of life.
Exactly.
If you have, what is our access and the quality of our access to these six things?
Exactly.
And you could tell the story of America just by looking at the six areas. You don't have to look beyond any, you don't have to get any other statistics. How do people live in our society?
Well, there's a big problem. I think the people, I agree with I disagreed at first, but now I'm starting to agree with your idea of a referendum. The people need to be involved in the process. And they're being shut out by this two-party system. I agree with you. When I was looking at the strong, functioning, healthy welfare states that exist in mostly in the Nordic countries in Europe, like Switzerland, Denmark, Norway, those kind of countries,
mm-hmm.
they invest a tremendous amount back into their social programs. And one of the things that I saw was they have a political culture that's very different than ours. Now, their political culture, one of the major underlying principles of a country like Norway, their political culture is an emphasis on economic equality. Now, what would we say if we would say, what is the major underlying principle of political culture in the United States? It's a total emphasis on economic equality. It's the opposite.
But I have to give you a caveat because I was invited, as a matter of fact, at the government of Sweden to take a look at an emerging problem that they were having, and that is multiculturalism is beginning to have an impact, a negative impact, and they're not dealing with it well. All these goods and services that are equally distributed in these societies were distributed on one particular basis, and that is the homogeneity of these societies.
Okay, so there's
in
a
Sweden,
racial problem.
In Sweden, simply because you're born in Sweden doesn't make you a Swede.
No, and I'm not suggesting that the system, I don't think that the system is an answer.
But what I'm trying to say is these things are fine, except now that there are more immigrants coming in, the countries are beginning to close in. And we see the development is very slow and very gradual, but it nonetheless exists. Thanks so much, Michael. We got to go. Thank you all for calling, Sarah, Richard, DX, and Michael. You made this a fantastic session today, and please come back tomorrow, and let's pick up from where we left off. Bye-bye.
But if you treat me right, baby, I'll stay home every day. If you treat